going? What a beautiful day to be in here, huh? It is nice to see the spring coming and the flowers starting to come back and leaves growing. And I appreciate the message Mr. Grady gave us today. I could tell he really put a lot of time and effort and studying into that. There will be no math in the sermon today, so... But I did appreciate that. That was very interesting. Today I'd like to talk about humility. Humility is a trait that is greatly misunderstood. A lot of times people will use false humility even to gain compliments. They'll say something like, "Oh, I'm not really a good singer." And wait for someone to say, "Oh, no, you are. You are. You're a really good singer." "No, I'm not. I'm not that good." "No, you are. You're a good singer." "Well, I do have a talent. I mean..." Some people will use false humility to get compliments from people. C.S. Lewis once said that humility is not thinking less of yourself, but thinking of yourself less. Humility is misunderstood as a weakness or putting one's self down. That is not what humility is. Jesus Christ was a very humble person. Jesus Christ did not think less of himself or put himself down. Humility is understanding where your talents come from that you have. Humility is defined as a quality or state of not thinking you are better than other people. A lot of people have problems with that, don't they? How much is humility to be a part of our lives? Turn with me, if you will, to 1 Peter 5, verses 5 and 6. First Peter 5, verses 5 and 6. We read, "Likewise, you younger people, submit yourselves to your elders. Yes, all of you, be submissive to one another and be clothed with humility. For God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time." Peter urges us to be clothed with humility. To be clothed with humility means to wear it like a garment. It becomes a part of who we are. It is constantly a part of us. It's on us all the time. It comes out in our conduct. It comes out in our conversation, our speech, everything that is a part of our life. Humility will come out if we are wearing it like clothing. Colossians 3, verses 12 through 14. If you'll turn over there, please. Colossians 3. "Therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering, bearing with one another and forgiving one another. If anyone has a complaint against another, but even as Christ forgave you, so you also must do. But above these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection." When we're told to put something on, to wear it, it then becomes a part of who we are. Humility must be a part of our character. As I mentioned earlier, Christ had humility. Christ had perfect humility. I'd like to turn over to Philippians chapter 2, verses 3 through 8. Philippians 2, verses 3 through 8. One thing Christ had to deal with a lot, and we're going to see a few of these interactions between him and those around him, he had to deal with a lack of humility. That's pretty amazing when you think about it. Here was the Son of God on earth dealing with the people around him having a lack of humility, thinking they were better than who he was. But Christ did have humility. Philippians 2, verses 3 through 8, "Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, But in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. It's hard for us to do sometimes, isn't it? Let each of you look out not only for his own interest, but for the interest of others. Let this mind be in you, which was in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God, did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a bondservant, and coming in the likeness of man. And being found in the appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even the death of the cross. Those verses we just read shows a lot about the humility that Christ had. To come to the earth as man and humble himself, not only to live as man lived, but to make himself obedient to the death of the cross. Not just death. Here's someone who had the ability to never face death, but he made himself obedient to death. And not just death, but the most horrible form of death that was in existence at the time, the death of the cross. The opposite of humility is to be prideful, to overthink your value, to place yourself higher than others. Again, this is a huge part of society today. In his sermon last week, Mr. McCready talked about the Passover service. He talked about the foot washing part of the Passover service and how we do that every year. Passover service is a time when we, as followers of Christ, follow the example that Christ set and we wash each other's feet. If we're willing to take part in a foot washing ceremony and live our lives in a spirit of foot washing, it will help us to develop the humility that we need to have as followers of Christ. Let's turn over to John chapter 13 and see what Christ had to say about this process of foot washing. John 13. We're going to read verses 1 through 17. Again, Christ had to deal a lot with the lack of humility of people around him. And as we're going to see, he really had to deal with this many times with his own disciples. This was something that kept springing up, and he had to kind of like open their eyes to see what humility actually was, what it was to be a leader, what it was to be someone great among people. John 13, verses 1 through 17. Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world. So that's the frame of mind that Christ is in. He knows his time is up. He's getting ready to depart. And as I said, it was going to be a horrible departure. This is the frame of mind Christ was in at this time. He loved his own who were... He loved them to the end. And supper being ended, verse 2, the devil having already put it in the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, that he had come from God and was going to God, he rose from supper, laid aside his garments, took a towel, and girded himself. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. Then he came to Simon Peter, and Peter said to him, Lord, are you washing my feet? Peter recognized this as a very humble service, something that a leader, a king, should not be doing. This was a servant's work. He says, are you washing my feet? And Jesus said to him, what I'm doing you do not understand now. And he didn't, and none of them did at this time. Christ was pointing that out to them. Peter said to him, you'll never wash my feet. And Christ said, if I do not wash you, you have no part with me. So Peter said to him, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head. There was a change of attitude, wasn't there? He wanted to have a part with Christ. He wanted to have this relationship with him. Even though he didn't understand what was going on, he wanted to have this relationship. Jesus said to him, he who is bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean. And you are all clean, but not all of you, for he knew who would betray him. Therefore he said, you are not all clean. So when he had washed their feet, taken his garments, and sat down again, he said to them, "Do you know what I have done to you?" It's a pretty big question at that time. Do you understand what just happened? And I would say that no, they did not. They did come to understand later, but at the time they did not understand. He says to them, verse 13, "You call me teacher and Lord and say, well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I've given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Most assuredly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who is sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them." Foot washing was something that was reserved for the lowest of the low servant at that time. Mr. McCready touched on this a little bit last week about why there was foot washing because of the dusty roads and the sandals and stuff. But it was something relegated to the very lowest of the servant. Now, I don't think everybody had servants back then. There's plenty of stories in here about the poor at that time. So not everyone had a servant who would perform a foot washing when someone came to their house. But the stuff needed to wash your feet were provided. There was the water, there was the towel, and you were welcome to wash your own feet. Nobody, like, just went out of their way to wash each other's feet, but it was something that was set up for you to be able to do it to yourself. It would have been very, very uncommon for a rabbi or a master or anyone higher up the social chain to wash the feet of someone lower than them on the social chain. It just wasn't done. For one thing, it showed your inferiority to that person. It certainly was not on the minds of the disciples at that time, was it? Let's look at a conversation that they were having among themselves. And this was either just prior to or just after Christ had washed their feet. I tend to think this was going on just prior to Christ getting up and washing their feet. Turn over with me, if you will, to Luke 22, verses 24 to 27. Luke 22, verses 24 to 27. "Now there was a dispute among them as to who should be considered the greatest." Here they are sitting in the presence of Jesus Christ, Creator. And they're arguing, who's the greatest among us? "Christ said to them, 'The kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and those who exercise authority over them are called benefactors. But not so among you. On the contrary, he who is greatest among you, let him be as the younger, and he who governs as he who serves. For who is greater, he who sits at the table or he who serves? Is it not he who sits at the table? Yet I am among you as one who serves." Christ was pointing out to them he was greater than them, but he was there to serve them. As I said, this discussion appears to have taken place just before Christ washed their feet. Washing each other's feet, it wasn't on their minds, was it? Now, we know it was a custom at that time to wash someone's feet when they came into your house, or to have someone do it, or to at least do it yourself. Think about this situation for a minute. Christ never had to leave the room. He didn't say, "Wait a minute, I'll be right back." He didn't have to go outside and get water. He didn't have to go borrow a pan from the neighbor or go get a towel out of the pantry somewhere. All this stuff was there. All this stuff was set up. I imagine it was put there when the room was made ready by Peter and John. Everything needed for the foot washing service was provided in this room. The only thing that was lacking was the humility for someone to get up and do it. Now, when you have this argument going on between these disciples about which one of us is the greatest, that tells you right there, nobody had the attitude of a foot washing moment at that time. It's hard to sit there and wash someone's feet and look up at them and say, who's greater, me or you? Because you're kind of already putting yourself in a position that they're greater than you. If you look on the internet, other places, if you look up the foot washing ceremony, people are so quick to say, well, we don't have to do that. That was an example Christ said. It was only for their time. We just have to have the attitude of foot washing. That's all we need to do. Well, I think Christ plainly set the example and plainly said that we are to literally wash each other's feet. Let's go back to John 13, verses 14 through 17. John 13, verses 14 through 17. This is what we just read a little bit ago when Christ got up and washed their feet. Verse 14, he says, if I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Most assuredly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who is sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. I think there's very little doubt here about what Christ is saying, is there? He says, I've done this. I'm setting an example. You are to do this also. This was something that we were being taught should be done every year by us. For those who say that we're not to do it literally, that this is just an attitude that we need to develop, I say to you, show me that attitude. Do you see that attitude in this world? Do you see the foot washing attitude among people that you're with every day? We live in a very pride, selfish world. And I believe that if more people literally washed each other's feet, that there would be more of an attitude of the foot washing service in this world. So for those who say that this is not necessary, we just have to have the attitude, I say this helps build the attitude of a foot washing attitude. It helps us to have humility and service towards one another. Christ spoke to the leaders, spoke about the leaders, how they lord over those who they're supposed to be taking care of, that there was a misconstrued concept of what a leader was. And he mentioned this several times. It's no different today, is it? Do you feel like our leaders are there to serve us? Yeah, it gets a little bit of a chuckle, doesn't it? I feel like our leaders are where they are to be served. And I don't know if you've been watching any of the debates or not, but this was very telling to me on one of the first debates when somebody asked Hillary Clinton about her illegal emails that she's been sending on her personal server. And before she could even answer, Bernie Sanders shouts out, I'm sick and tired of hearing about Hillary's stupid emails. He didn't say stupid, but you get the point. And she starts laughing and she starts yelling, me too, I'm tired of hearing about these emails. And the two of them had this, you know, kind of a high five moment, like, yeah, we told them. And I thought, they basically just shut this reporter down and said, don't ask us about our illegal activities. They're not even subject to the laws that they passed for you and I. Basically, what she did with her emails could borderline be considered treason. I mean, it's amazing. And she's been asked several times, do you think are you going to be prosecuted for this? Is there going to be any trouble coming from this? And she just kind of laughs and says, no, there's no trouble coming from that. I don't feel like our leaders are out there to serve us. Can you picture members of Congress washing each other's feet? No? Especially those of the opposing party. Could you imagine that? Could you imagine if Congress opened up one day and they said, we're going to wash each other's feet to develop some humility? Can you picture your senator washing your feet? Maybe, since it's an election year. Right? They kind of go out of their way a little bit right now, don't they? But once they get it in Washington, I think our needs kind of fall behind. Christ said it wasn't supposed to be like that with us. If we want to be great, then we must be servants. Those who exercise authority don't understand what it's like to truly serve someone. Christ understood service. Christ understood what it was like to be humble and to have his thoughts going out to those who were lower than him, less than him. Because think about it, who isn't? We're all lower than Christ. Yet he did us all a great service by being sacrificed for our sins. That was the life that Christ lived, one of constant humility. And it was a lesson that he repeatedly had to give to his disciples. I mean, you can read through several times throughout Christ's life, and there's his disciples again. Who's the greatest? And one time he had to bring up a little child, and he said, "You have to become like this child. You don't have to be the one who lords over everyone." Humility is a funny thing when you think about it that way. Turn with me, if you will, to Matthew 20, verses 20 to 28. Another instance where Christ had to deal with the disciples wanting to be the greatest. Once again, jockeying for position. Matthew 20, verses 20 through 28. Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to him with her sons, kneeling down and asking something from him. So next time they brought Mama with them. And he said to her, "What do you wish?" She said to him, "Grant that these two sons of mine may sit on your right hand and the other on the left in your kingdom." So what's she asking for? She wanted them to be number one and number two in the kingdom, behind Christ. She wanted her sons to be moved up above all the other disciples. Jesus answered and said, "You do not even know what you're asking." He asked the two, he said, "Are you able to drink the cup that I am about to drink and be baptized with the baptism that I will be baptized with?" They were about to find out what service really was, where humility would lead them. But they weren't thinking about that at the time. They quickly answered, "We are able. We're able to take that baptism and to take that drink." So he said to them, "You will indeed drink my cup and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with. But to sit on my right hand and my left hand is not mine to give, but is for those whom is prepared for by my Father." And when the ten heard it, they were greatly displeased with the two brothers. But Jesus called them to himself and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you, for whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant, and whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave." This was not the attitude that the disciples were coming up with. Again and again, they kept jockeying for this position. They wanted to be high up. And Christ kept telling them again and again, if you want to be great, become a servant. Christ goes on, verse 28. He says, they're to become humble just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. Again, Christ is telling him, you want to be great? You want that high position? Look around you. Find needs. Serve those who need to be served. Become willing to give your life for those people. Without humility, it's impossible to serve God. In fact, without humility, God can't really use you. There's not much he can do with someone who's not humble enough to realize that everything we have comes from God. Let's look at Luke 18, verses 9 through 14. I'm amazed sometimes at how many situations Christ and his disciples would come around with people thinking they were so great. I don't know if this was something of the culture at that time or if it was just something that happened around Christ all the time. But Luke 8, verses 9 through 14, he spoke this parable to some. And who's he speaking it to? Some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and they despised others. They didn't just think that they were righteous, but they despised everybody else around them who they considered was not righteous. That's the group Christ is addressing here. It says, two men went up to the temple to pray. One was a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself. I think that's an interesting sentence right there, isn't it? Prayed thus with himself. God's not listening. Who's he praying to? And we're going on here for a minute, and then we'll see. This isn't even a prayer. This is a public proclamation. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, God, I thank you that I am not like the other men. And here's what he thought about the other men around him. Extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I possess. How many times does he say the word I? Who's he giving credit to here? Is he giving credit to God? No, he's almost like he's saying, God, you should be thankful that I do all this stuff. So he's loudly proclaiming in the middle of everyone here what all he does. And the icing on the cake is he picks someone out of the crowd around him and says, I'm glad I'm not even like that person. The tax collector, verse 13, standing afar off. This wasn't even somebody beside him. This was somebody afar off. So he had to basically be yelling all this stuff for this person afar off to even hear that this man had said this stuff about him. That's how loudly this man was proclaiming how great he was. The tax collector, standing afar off, would not so much raise his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. The tax collector, upon hearing of how great this man was, couldn't even raise his eyes to look up to the heavens. Let on to raise his eyes to look at someone around him to say, well, at least I'm not that person. He humbly just asked God for forgiveness. The prideful Pharisee was someone that God could not work with. He did all these things and, you know, why? Why was he doing all that stuff? Was he fasting to become humble? Was he fasting to become closer to God? Was he tithing on everything to become closer to God? Sounds like he did all this stuff just so he could stand out in the middle of the street and let everyone know he did it. We must have humility if God is to work with us. We cannot have an attitude like that. This is evident in the life of Moses. Moses had to have humility before God could work with him. Let's turn back to Exodus chapter 3. Exodus chapter 3, I want to read verses 1 through 11. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock back to the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush. So he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, but the bush was not consumed. Moses said, I will now turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush does not burn. So when the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called out to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. Then he said, Do not draw near this place. Take off your sandals off your feet, for the place where you're standing is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt, and I have heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. So I have come down to deliver them out of the land of the Egyptians and to bring them up from the land to a good and large land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come now, therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, Who am I that I should go before Pharaoh, and that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? Moses asked God, Who am I? You want to send me before Pharaoh? You want to send me to lead out your people from the land of Egypt? Who am I, God, that I would do this? It's a very interesting question, especially for Moses. We know that Moses was raised up differently from the other Israelites, although he was one of them. One time, Moses considered himself to be the perfect one to do this job. Moses figured he was going to be the one to lead the Israelites out of Egypt. In fact, he once made an attempt to do so before, and he failed. Things didn't go his way, and now God's telling him, now's time, I want you to go back. He's not feeling very confident. He's probably thinking back to the time before when he tried to free them and thinking, I don't know, that didn't work so good last time. Let's consider Moses' life before he tried to undertake the task of freeing Israel. Moses was born a slave, but he didn't stay that way for very long. When he was still an infant, he was adopted by one of Pharaoh's daughters. Let's turn over to the book of Acts. Acts chapter 7, verses 20 to 22. Acts chapter 7, verse 20. At this time Moses was born and was well pleasing to God, and he was brought up in his father's house for 3 months. But then he was set out. Pharaoh's daughter took him in and brought him up as her own son. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and deeds. I think that's interesting to read that he was mighty in words and deeds when God does finally tell him he's going to go lead Israel out. Moses starts saying, well, I don't even know how to talk. How would I go before a Pharaoh? Well, he was quite well versed and trained. Moses was going places. He was somebody. He was somebody in the land of Egypt. He was very high up in the government. Some people say he was being groomed to be the very next Pharaoh. He was a part of the royal family, and he considered it would be him who would free the Israelites. We see this going on here in Acts 7, verses 23 and 24. Now when he was 40 years old, it came to his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended and avenged him who was oppressed and struck down the Egyptian. You might want to put a marker here or something. I want to go back to Exodus chapter 2 and read this particular event happening. There's a little more of an explanation going on back here in Exodus 2, verses 11 through 15. Exodus 2, verse 11. Now it came to pass in those days when Moses was grown that he went out to his brethren and looked at their burdens. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that way, and when he saw no one, he killed the Egyptian. And he hid him in the sand. And when he went out the second day, behold, two Hebrew men were fighting. And he said to the one who did the wrong, "Why are you striking your companion?" When I read this, sometimes I think, so many different situations. Why are you fighting amongst yourselves? I think of our own nation sometimes, you know. We have race warfare. We have class warfare. We have states fighting each other for water rights. Why are we fighting each other? We have common enemies. This is what Moses was saying to them. He's like, why are you guys fighting each other? You should be banding together. We have a common enemy. Verse 14, the person he asks to said, "Who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" So Moses feared and said, "Surely this thing is known." Verse 15, when Pharaoh heard of this matter, he sought to kill Moses, but Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Let's go back now to Acts chapter 7. Acts chapter 7, verse 25, picking up here right after Moses had killed this Egyptian and hid him. Verse 25 says, "For he supposed that his brethren would have understood that God would deliver them by his hand, but they did not understand. And the next day he appeared to two of them as they were fighting and tried to reconcile them, saying, 'Men, you are brethren, why do you wrong one another?' But he who did this to his neighbor wrong pushed him away and said, 'Who made you a ruler and a judge over us? Do you intend to kill me as you did the Egyptian yesterday?' Then at this saying, Moses fled and became a dweller in the land of Midian, where he had two sons." Moses was rejected by his people. He was rejected by the people he was working up a scheme to free. They rejected him. They said, "Who made you a ruler and a judge over us?" Moses was not a very humble person at this time. Moses had been raised up as royalty. All of a sudden, Moses was only interested in freeing one Israelite, and he fled. His job was done as far as he was concerned. The thing is, Moses probably could have stayed the course. He probably could have went on, and at some time he probably could have freed the Israelites from the position he was in. But he would have never been able to give them the victory that God gave. You know, he could have somehow, I don't know whether just told them they could leave or told them you're no longer slaves, you're just a part of society now. But who knows how history would have turned out. He could have angered the Egyptians. He could have been assassinated. And of course, Egypt would still have its army. Things had to be done in God's time and God's way for there to be a total victory. God wanted Moses to free the slaves, but Moses had to become humble. He had to come to the point where he did not see himself as the deliverer that he once saw himself as. He had to come to the point that when God said, "It's time for you to go and free the slaves," that Moses had to say, "Who am I that you would send me to free these slaves?" Moses was humbled being a shepherd for 40 years. He was gone. Genesis 46, verse 34, you don't have to turn there, but Genesis 46, verse 34 tells us that the Egyptians really looked down on shepherds. It said that every shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians. Moses had to become something that was probably throughout his first 40 years of his life taught was detestable, was beneath him. Moses had to become a shepherd for 40 years. He no longer saw himself as one who could deliver the Israelites. He could no longer depend on his strength, his wisdom, or his power. Moses had to rely fully on God. Because of his humility, Moses became someone that God could use. As we examine ourselves during this Passover season, humility is something we need to be looking for. I'm going to wrap up today by looking at some of the characteristics of humility, something for you to be looking for in your lives. I only have five. There's more that you can discover on your own, but these five are a start as we begin to examine ourselves for humility. Number one, a humble person will ask for help when needed and does not insist on everything being done their way. A non-humble person thinks their way is right no matter what, and it's hard to convince them of anything different. This is what Moses had to learn. He had his own thoughts about how to free the Israelites. He had his own plan. He had his own timing. But he had to come to depend on God to do it his way, with his timing. And as I said, otherwise there would not have been this total victory that the Israelites had on their way out. Number two, a humble person gives credit where it's due. First and foremost, we must recognize what God does through us. We must give God the credit for everything that we are. And also, don't forget those who God sends along the way to help us. Moses could no longer take credit for freeing the slaves. He knew it wasn't going to be him. His time had come and go to do that on his own. The third thing, a humble person is forgiving. We must be quick to forgive because we all have been forgiven so much. And when we forget all the things that we've been forgiven, then we stop being forgiven of other people. We start not understanding, why aren't they more like me? Why aren't they better? Ephesians 4, verse 32. You don't have to turn there. You can write it down. Ephesians 4, verse 32 says, "Be kind to one another. Be tenderhearted. Forgive one another, even as God in Christ forgave you." That's a tall order. Be forgiving as God. That, of course, depends upon our realization that we need to be forgiven. We can't have the attitude of the Pharisee who all he could see was the great things that he did. So proud of himself, he had to pronounce it to everyone. We have to see where we fall short, where we need forgiveness. Number four, a humble person is thankful. When we stop being thankful and start taking credit for everything we have, we stop realizing that God is giving us what we need, sustaining our lives, giving us the very air to breathe. We stop being humble. Deuteronomy chapter 8, God reminded Israel it was Him who brought them out of the land of Egypt. It was Him who took them through the wilderness, and it was Him who was going to deliver them into the promised land. He warned them not to forget Him, not to start thinking that it was by some great power that they had that they made this journey and was coming into this land. Because unthankfulness would lead to disobedience. And we see throughout history that that's happened over and over, unfortunately, with Israel. And number five, a humble person has to have a servant's heart. Christ said those who would be great would be those who would have the heart of a servant. Those who are willing to look out for the needs of others. Not someone who would point at someone and say, "Oh, I'm glad I'm not like that person. They must be miserable." But someone who would rather go over and help that person than to point them out and say, "I'm glad I'm not like that person." In the parable of the Good Samaritan, Christ wraps up the story by saying, "Which of these do you think was the neighbor to him who fell among the thieves?" And they answered him and said, "He who showed mercy on him." Jesus said to him, "Go and do likewise. Have that humble heart of a servant." Humility is one of the basic requirements that God makes of us. If you'll turn with me over to Micah 6. Micah 6, verse 8. Micah 6, verse 8 says, "He has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? But to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God." Again, humility is one of the basic requirements God makes of us. There's a saying that Christians have a choice. We can either be humble or we can be humbled. So let's examine ourselves. Let's see if humility is a part of our being. Let's put on humility. Wear it like a coat. Make it a part of who we are. And let's develop and maintain that foot washing attitude.